I'm Melissa Martins Casagrande. This is number 0237, the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder, and it comes to you right now.
The following program is brought to you in living color.
Now, it's time for an eclectic mix of interviews and some of the oddest news stories you'll ever hear. It's the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder.
Hey there, hi there, ho there! Peter Anthony Holder here with you, and yes, this is indeed another edition of the Stuff File program, number 0237. And coming up on this edition of the Stuff File program, Andrew Vazakis, the night sky guy, is back. He's on to talk about the recent discovery of 715 new planets.
I think it's awesome to live in the day and age where we're now not talking about finding new worlds in our doorstep. We're looking at planets revolving around stars that are up to 3,000 light years away. So it's pretty incredible, and I think we're just touching the tip of the iceberg now that we've got our techniques squared away and we're able to rack up these worlds, I think, and not just in dozens, but scores of them at a time.
Rich Sheban is the author of One New York Man's Journey to Off-Grid Living in Montana.
My dreams when I was growing up in the metropolitan area of New York City was to come out to the Northern Rockies, hunt, fish, and live my dream, my goals, if you will. And at 19, I decided I was going to make that dream come true. At 26, I pulled the trigger on that dream. I had a lot of barriers. In fact, that's why the book I wrote talks about the financial, economic, social, and political reasons why we need to be self-sufficient. It's not just a how-to book, and it tells a story that I hope is motivating to some folks as well.
Stuart Nullman is back with another edition of Book Banter.
Hi, I'm Stuart Nullman, and Book Banter will crack some more spines with Joe Queenan's One for the Books. So bookworms unite! A little bit later on the Stuff File program.
And there's lots and lots and lots of stuff, and of course, an idiot of the day. The guest Slater, the person who told you this was show number 0237, was Melissa Martins Casagrande, an international lawyer working in the UK. Thank you very much, Melissa, for doing the guest slate on this edition of the Stuff File program, a program that's also heard on Stitcher Smart Radio, the smarter way to listen to radio. Well, let's get right to the stuff, shall we? Well, Norway's prison system is regarded as among the most inmate-friendly in the world, but convicted mass murderer Anders Breivik is still not impressed. Breivik is serving 21 years for the 2011 bomb and gun attacks that killed 77 people and may already enjoy amenities unheard of for a comparable North American murderer. But he sent wardens 12 demands in November, including an upgrade of his manual typewriter and his PlayStation 2 to a PS3 with better access to game selection. He also demanded that his weekly government allowance, which is the equivalent of $49, be doubled, and that if the torture of his living conditions is not relieved, he would be forced into a hunger strike. Breivik threatened a similar strike in 2012, citing inhumane conditions such as cold coffee, lack of skin moisturizer, and insufficient butter for his bread. Yeah, okay. Doesn't a story like this just make your skin crawl? I have climbed on this soapbox before to talk about hunger strikes in general, but I will have to say it again here. I have never understood the concept of a hunger strike. It always appears to me to be the adult equivalent of a child who threatens to hold their breath until they turn blue. If your idea of pressuring me to do something is to threaten not to eat, then I, in a most defiant form of mockery, will sit in front of you each and every day of your hunger strike and eat a 7-course meal. Because you voluntarily deciding not to eat in order to make a protest point of some kind is never something I'm ever going to care about, regardless of the validity of the issue. Your slow, painful, self-inflicted death will just amuse me. Now, back to Breivik. He murdered 77 people, and he has a PlayStation 2 and a manual typewriter, and he's not happy. Newsflash. You're not supposed to be happy. You murdered 77 young people before their full lives even began. I'm not sure I'd even give you a Commodore 64 and a chisel and tablet. And skin moisturizer? Pal, I want you gray, pasty, and flaky for the next 21 years at least. Okay, I'll step down from the soapbox for now. And by the way, if you have any thoughts on this clown, don't hesitate to drop me a line via email at peter@thestufffile.com. That's peter@thestufffile.com. And once again, stuff is spelled S-T-U-P-H. 21 years. I'm hoping he doesn't get out in 21 years, too. But that's another story for another day. Like, you know, in about 20 years from now. Moving right along, when a brand new, exhaustively itemized U.S. medical coding system debuts in October, which was planned, by the way, long before Obamacare, doctors will find, for example, dozens of separate numbers to describe dealings with patients' big toe, as in left one, right one, with or without nail damage, blisters, abrasions, critter bites, fractures, dislocations, sprains, amputations, etc. Among the odder listed origins of injury reported the New York Times in December are codes for burning water skis and injuries incurred in opera houses or while knitting or as a manifestation of sibling rivalry. The current system has about 17,000 codes, but the new one totals 68,000 for diagnoses plus 87,000 for procedures. Okay. Why does there have to be a code dealing with an injury due to sibling rivalry? I mean, if I'm a healthcare professional and you're rushed into the ER, is it really important to know as I'm removing nail gun projectiles from your scrotum that the person who fired the nail gun was your next door neighbor or your drunk sister? Oh, it's going to be a hoot to fill out these forms, I'm sure. And finally, in this section of Stuff File News, before we get to our first guest here on the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder, we have three stories together that deal with people who seem to be highly educated, but short-tempered. Story number one. Following an evening of heavy drinking, according to police in Russia in January, a former schoolteacher, age 52, was charged with fatally stabbing his host, age 67, during a dispute over whether poetry or prose is the more important literary form. I know people who might kill over bad limericks, but that's ridiculous. Story number two. One Russian man shot another, non-fatally, with rubber bullets, in the town of Rostov-on-Don in September in an argument over theories of German philosopher Immanuel Kant. Well, can't we just get along? And story number three, Nadia Svensson, age 22, was charged on Christmas Eve in Londonderry, New Hampshire, a night, by the way, which had clear skies, apparently, with stabbing her father in the chest during bickering over the position of the Big Dipper. Gee, I don't think that's a story they'll be laughing about together on subsequent Christmas get-togethers, but that's just me. Let's talk about nicer things in the heavens. Not that the Big Dipper isn't nice, it is. I don't want to deal with these two people who are arguing over it. Let's just get to our first guest, is what I'm trying to say on this edition of the Stuff File program. Yes. The Kepler Space Telescope has made a discovery that has astronomers cheering. The discovery of many more orbs out there. 715 new planets have been found. That's right, 715. Science writer Andrew Vazakis, the night sky guy, is back on the program to talk about it. He joins us via Skype-to-Skype communications from Florida. Hi, Andrew.
Hey, Peter.
So are you giddy like a schoolgirl over the fact that there are these 715 new planets?
Yeah, I think it's awesome. I mean, to live in the day and age where we're now not talking about finding new worlds, you know, in our doorstep. We're looking at planets revolving around stars that are up to 3,000 light years away. So it's pretty incredible, and I think we're just touching the tip of the iceberg now. Now that we've got our techniques squared away and we're able to rack up these worlds, I think not just in dozens, but scores of them at a time.
One of the things in reading a story about this that I found interesting is that there are two terms: probable candidates and planets, basically.
Right. So what happens is that when the Kepler Space Telescope, this is NASA's premier planet hunting telescope that was launched in 2009, it's cost them almost $500 million, the mission. This telescope finds planets by what's called the transit method. Basically, this is when they watch a planet move in front of a star, and the star's light slightly winks out while the planet goes in front of the star. So this is sort of like a mini eclipse that happens. Now, what the problem has been is that you need to verify these planets. So they have to have a second or tertiary telescope on the ground do follow-up observations. And until that is done, you have only candidate planets. And what we're talking about here, though, is confirmed planets. And that's thanks to actually a new technique that NASA has just developed, and it's called verification by multiplicity. And what that means is that now astronomers with this new technique are able to distinguish between, say, watching a group of stars huddled together, a little cluster of stars that orbit each other, from a single star that's orbited by a family of planets. So that's why this number that we're talking about today of 715 worlds that are discovered, the number is so high is because they're actually finding family of planets around single stars. And this is a big step forward in the science.
And family of planets is much similar to, well, basically our solar system, right? Which is a family
exactly.
of planets.
That's right. It's a family of, you've got the sun at the center, and then you've got all these orbiting worlds from Mercury out to Neptune and now dwarf planet Pluto.
Okay, so the fact that we have found these 715 new planets and we were so quick to be able to verify them, is the quickness in which they were verified in itself an amazing scientific breakthrough?
Well, it is, because we're using the power of supercomputing as well, as involved heavily into this, in that our ability to take data, the raw data that a telescope like this is beaming down to Earth, and we're doing the number crunching so fast thanks to our technology that we can really whittle down all the ones that are, you know, are not planets very, very quickly. But what's very interesting here is that it seems from our data that Mother Nature tends to favor small planets. And by small planets, I mean Earth-sized planets, rocky terrestrial planets the size of Mars, Venus, and Earth. Those tend to be very common, according to this data.
And yet, despite the fact that they might be common and there are 715 new planets, they have not found a so-called Earth 2.0, have they?
Well, no. And this is what's interesting, though, that we're getting closer, because there's four planets in this batch that orbit their stars and are what are called the habitable zone. This is, or some people call it the Goldilocks zone. And that's this region around a star, this certain distance, where the temperatures are just right for liquid water to exist. And I'm not saying that there's oceans on these four worlds, but the possibility of life is much greater because they're just the right place. It's not too hot, not too cold, hence the Goldilocks analogy, that they may support liquid water in abundance, too. And if that's the case, then they could be candidates for looking in the future for life there.
I have been reading some stories, and one of the problems I understand that they are finding is that these planets are their suns might not be the size of ours, yet some of these planets might be larger, like mini Neptunes in size. So that can be problematic for any kind of life.
Well, yeah, because you've got to find that sweet spot. So you can have a star that's smaller than the sun, which would mean that it's cooler in temperature. But if it's a cooler, smaller sun, you'd want Earth-like planets to be hugging those stars much closer than our Earth is hugging our star, orbiting our star, the Sun. So you need to find that habitable zone in a different place, much closer. So smaller stars than our Sun would have a habitable zone much closer in, and then if it's a much larger star, it would be much farther out because the heat of the star would be much greater. And if we're talking about large planets like Neptune, these gas giants, we don't think there would necessarily be hospitable for life, these gas giants. But what's interesting, from what we see in our solar system, a lot of these gas giants could have moons. And those moons may be where life may evolve. And that, of course, harkens to that famous movie Avatar, right? If you think back, James Cameron's Avatar, the moons are where all the action was happening.
Okay. So two reasons to be excited. One, the discovery of 750 new planets. Two, the relative speed in which those planets went from candidate planets to actual planets. Those two things put together, does it bode well for a third possibility, and that is the quicker discovery of more planets out there? In other words, by finding these planets where they are, does it now point scientists in a direction to where other planets can be?
Well, I mean, the ultimate goal, the holy grail here, of course, is finding Earth 2.0, right? A twin of Earth. And really, we have to be maybe a little bit flexible in thinking, well, it's not necessarily going to be in the exact same position and the exact same size as the Earth is to have something to have similar conditions, so that are suitable for life and may even host life. That's what we're learning. But I mean, what we're showing here is that the statistics, we're looking at the statistics of solar system, we're trying to fill out that scoreboard, and what scientists are trying to get a sense of is how typical our solar system is, the makeup of our solar system, the whole setup of the planets, where you have rocky terrestrial worlds closer into the Sun, and then you have these gas giants farther away. And what this data is showing us from Kepler is that indeed our own solar system setup may be a very common thing in the entire galaxy of the Milky Way. And you have to remember, Peter, that the Milky Way is home, we think, from the latest data, if you extrapolate it out to the entire galaxy of 100 billion suns, there may be as many as 17 billion rocky worlds that are similar to Earth. And that's not even talking about the hundreds of billions of larger planets out there as well. And that's just within our Milky Way galaxy.
Well, let me ask you this double-prong question. Do you personally, someone who studies this, is a fan of this, reads up on this, and teaches on this, do you think Earth 2.0 is out there? And
I think
and more importantly, do you think Earth 2.0, if there is one or more than one, has some form of life on it?
Well, I think from what we're seeing already, the data, and we're working with at the beginning of our technology and being able to search for smaller planets, rocky terrestrial-like planets. I think there's no doubt in my mind that we're going to find something extremely similar to Earth, something that where there is going to be water, there may even be signs of life. I think it's very, very likely. And a lot of the scientists in the field, they are taking bets amongst themselves that they think that we may be 5 to 10 years away to find something that would be actual habitable world that's very similar to Earth. 5 to 10 years, can you imagine that, Peter? And really, the technology is already on the drawing boards. And one of the things I just have to mention to you that is so exciting is how are we going to be able to do this, is that by looking at the atmosphere, actually taking a chemical fingerprint of the atmospheres of these worlds. That's what the next generation of telescopes will be able to do. And we're going to be looking at things like oxygen. We're going to look for things like methane, which is a byproduct of life here on Earth. Chlorophyll, also a byproduct of plant life. This could really tell an entire story of a planet just by looking at these chemicals that are in the atmosphere, and we're very close to being able to do that. So you cannot help but feel excited about the possibilities.
less than a minute here. 715 planets. Is it somebody's job out there to name them?
You know what? That's what a lot of people are asking. So can't astronomers come up with something more more romantic than Kepler 36b and things like that? I mean, really, there is an International Astronomical Union, a body of astronomers that actually officially name these objects. But with the numbers that are raking up right now, I don't know if we're going to be able to find names for every single one quickly enough, because they're just coming in so fast.
Yeah, it's like the proud parents who are looking to have a baby and then they find out they have quadruplets. It's like, oh gosh, we need multiple names.
I definitely wouldn't want to be a kid in the elementary school having to learn all these. What is it now? 715 new names.
Exactly. Well, better them than me.
That's right.
Andrew, always a pleasure to have you on the program. Go to your site, which is thenightskyguy.com. What else are you working on?
Right, and people can also visit me at National Geographic under the Starstruck column, which I write every week for them, and they can get a lot of their weekly dose of stargazing news from there. And, of course, visit me on my Facebook page and Twitter account, The Night Sky Guy.
Thank you very much, Andrew.
My pleasure, and clear skies.
Andrew Fizakis, The Night Sky Guy. You can check out his website at thenightskyguy.com, and, of course, you'll find the link on my website, at thestufffile.com.
You're listening to The Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder. Drop Peter a line. He'd love to hear from you. You can email him at peter@thestufffile.com or catch up with him on Twitter or Facebook. There's more Stuff File coming your way in just a few moments.
Kelly Alexander Show is your place to be for everything to do with health, lifestyle, and entertainment. Join us as we chat with celebrities like Emmy winner Mia Michaels from So You Think You Can Dance, best-selling recording artist Taylor Dane, and world-renowned astronaut Julie Payette. We also cover important topics like breast cancer awareness and how to help your child through bullying. All this and more, please join us, www.kellyalexandershow.com.
It's The Kelly Alexander Show.
Capture your need for sound.
Peter Anthony Holder here. Have you ever noticed on some of those public broadcasting pledge drives, they tend to sound like ransom demands in a kidnapping?
Hey, your kids like this, Mr. Rogers. It would be most unfortune if, for some unforeseen reason, you weren't in the neighborhood no more.
Well, I'm here to ask for your support in a non-threatening, non-obligatory kind of way. Part of the success of The Stuff File depends on the generosity of its listeners worldwide. So if you can, and if you want, please feel free to make a small one-time donation. Just go to the website at thestufffile.com and click on the PayPal donation button. You can donate $10, $5, or even $1, whatever you'd like.
You know that big bird? That would be one huge drumstick, if you know what I mean.
If you have a PayPal account, it's an easy transfer. And if you don't, all major credit cards are accepted. Your generosity would be much appreciated in keeping this show running.
About that antique roadshow, they might be seeing a little more concrete than they originally anticipated.
No strong-arm tactics, no ransom demands. Just a simple please and thank you. To donate, visit thestufffile.com.
Choosy mothers choose The Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder. If your mother didn't choose it for you, well, I guess she just doesn't love you.
And still to come on the program, we will talk to a man who is living off the grid. Plus, Stuart Nauman is back with another edition of Book Banter. And we have more Stuff File news and, of course, an idiot of the day coming your way. All here on a program that's also heard on Stitcher Smart Radio, the smarter way to listen to radio. Well, victim, and I'm doing air quotes here, victim Joseph Torres, age 27, was at home in Las Cruces, New Mexico on New Year's Day with his fiance and young son when four men barged in after threatening Torres on the telephone with, "I'm Big East Side. I'll kill you and your family. I will go to your house." Torres is a mixed martial arts fighter, and by the time it was over, he and his family were fine, thank you very much. But one home invader was dead, another was in the hospital, and the other two, including the telephoner, were under arrest. Well, they now certainly know who they shouldn't mess with. On the other side of that coin, it is kind of nice that they had the good manners to call ahead before showing up, huh? Yeah. Speaking of not ready for primetime crime, here's another winner for you. Andre Bacon, age 21, was arrested in February in the Cragen neighborhood of Chicago after police said he tried to carjack a woman who was about to get into her car in her own garage. The woman gave up her keys but ran out and closed the door as she left, locking Bacon in the garage with no way out. Police arrived minutes later to find Bacon sitting meekly in the driver's seat. I'm not about to condone crime. No, not at all. But if you're going to go to the trouble of carjacking a vehicle, but you find yourself locked in the garage, the very least you could do is, you know, start the car and crash through the door, or better yet, perhaps check under the visor and see if there's one of those nifty garage door openers there, or check the door mechanism to see if there's an inside release. I'm just saying. I mean, sitting there in the car, waiting to be arrested, seems kind of counterproductive, doesn't it? Yeah. Anyway, here's an interesting headline for you. The headline read, "Man arrested allegedly trying to sell stolen brains at Dairy Queen." Yeah. Do I really need to go on? I mean, haven't you just heard enough just hearing that headline? Oh, okay, I'll finish the story. David Charles, age 21, was charged in Indianapolis in January with arranging the deal, which involved 60 jars of mental patients' brains, some from as far back as the 1800s, stolen from the Indiana Medical History Museum. The buyer, who was actually an undercover cop, had agreed to meet at the restaurant. Okay, let's ponder this thought process here for a second or two, shall we? At what point do you come across 60 jars containing medical patients' brains, and the thought crosses your cranium that these would be a great item to fence? I mean, that's the kind of thinking that will probably lead to your brain being in a jar one day. Yeah. Let's move on to the Darwin Starter Kit, shall we? Because if you listen to this program enough, you've often heard the Darwin file stories, where basically the tree of life is often self-pruning. So if I say Darwin Starter Kit, then you know automatically that the person at the end of the story is still alive, but there's room for improvement. So here's this edition of the Darwin Starter Kit. A fellow by the name of Herod Lubin, age 41, was driving in Orlando, Florida, when he was stopped at a railway crossing. Now, he didn't see a train coming, so he drove around the crossing gates and didn't quite get all the way over the tracks before he was plowed by a train going 79 miles an hour. Not only was he not seriously injured, but his baby's mother, who was not wearing her seatbelt, was not seriously injured either. Their 5-month-old son, however, was ejected from the car. He, however, landed in a soft patch of dirt and was also not seriously injured. An amazed Florida Highway Patrol trooper handed Lubin a ticket, charging him with driving around a railroad crossing armbar and for not using an approved child restraint. A child restraint for the child or a restraint for him? I'm trying to figure that one out. Anyway, seriously, how do you pull this off and only get a ticket? I mean, surely there is something you can arrest this guy for. Child endangerment, for starters. That's why I call this, again, the Darwin Starter Kit story, because at some point, this clown will do something stupid enough to remove himself from the planet. It's just a matter of time. And we have time for one more story here in the Stuff File News section before we get to our next guest here on the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder. When a suspected vehicle thief showed up in an allegedly stolen truck, the owner of McMahon's Wrecking in Cleveland, Ohio, took action. "I had been looking for this guy for weeks," said owner Donnie McMahon. "The police always come by to let us know who to be on the lookout for." McMahon called the police and went outside to stall him. When it looked like the suspect was going to drive off, McMahon ordered an employee to bring a forklift behind the truck and lift its rear wheels off the ground. The wheels were just spinning away. McMahon said the driver looked a little surprised. He wasn't going anywhere. He told the driver, "You're going to jail now, you punk." It's kind of Clint Eastwood-like, isn't it? Yeah. Police arrived and arrested the man, whose name is being withheld until charges are filed, thus giving him a short reprieve before He's the laughingstock of all of his friends and probably everyone else on cell block D. Anyway, moral of the story, when stealing a vehicle, make sure it's front wheel or all wheel drive so that you don't have to worry about a forklift, you know, lifting up the back of your truck and you're not going anywhere. Shall we get to our next guest here on the Stuff All program? Yes, I think that would be a good idea. Could you live off the grid? Rich Sheban, who grew up in New York City, has done just that. Rich lives in Montana and is the author of One New York Man's Journey to Off-Grid Living in Montana. He joins us on the line from Montana right now. Hi, Rich.
Hi, Peter. How are you today?
Just tickety-boo. Thanks for being on the program with us. Now, I use the term off the grid, and people have two ideas about when someone lives off the grid. One is completely disappearing, and one is living without electricity or modern conveniences. Just by the very fact that I'm talking to you via telephone means you're not completely off the grid, you're just off the electrical grid, correct?
That's absolutely correct. In fact, a lot of people have different definitions, like you just mentioned, but off the grid is really a simple fact that we are not hooked up to the corporate electric grid. So that leaves two choices. You either make your own electricity, which I do with the solar array, or you choose to go without electricity, which I know homes who do that as well.
Now, what led you to doing this or wanting to do this?
Well, I have an innate love and passion and enthusiasm for nature and the outdoors. So my dreams when I was growing up in the metropolitan area of New York City was to come out to the Northern Rockies, hunt and fish, and live my dream, my goals, if you will. And at 19, I decided I was going to make that dream come true. At 26, I pulled the trigger on that dream. And it took, I had a lot of barriers. In fact, that's why the book I wrote talks about the financial, economic, social, and political reasons why we need to be self-sufficient. And it's not just a how-to book, and it tells a story that I hope is motivating to some folks as well. So it's always been a target of mine to live off the land, to enjoy nature, everything from growing your own garden and produce to edible and medicinal plants, hunting your own meat, fishing, catching, canning everything. I mean, everything is just natural and fun.
You mentioned some of the barriers you had when you first started this journey. What were some of the biggest obstacles you had to surmount?
Well, there was a lot of them. I would say the biggest barrier that I specifically had was affirmative action and quotas that I had to deal with. For example, a degree in forestry. I went to an interview with the National Forest Service, and they told me they would not hire me as a white male. And when I was with a major pharmaceutical company, I was working for 7 years with spinal stenosis and nerve damage. My attorneys tell me that I should not get medical tests, because if I got these objective medical tests, they would put me on disability. I was begging my company because I was in such pain, working with painkillers while driving a company car, asking if I could go part-time. They told me, human resources told me, it was for women only. So I worked an extra 7 years with a lot of pain, and I decided that since this was my dream in the first place, I was going to pull the trigger on living off-grid and being as self-sufficient as I possibly can, because I feel, Peter, that our society what's happened in America is what I call the triple D effect. We've been distracted, dumbed down, and divided. We are not the United States of America. We are the divided states of America. So a lot of too many people are turning into followers and not thinkers. What I'm trying to promote is synergy over division. And that's one of my reasons for doing these radio programs, for writing the book, to show people that there's a plan B, a plan C, there's other options on how to live and how to control your own destiny, because the middle class is losing all its ground that it's gained over the last several decades. And I feel we should judge by hard work, effort, proven results, qualifications, word of honor, tenacity, discipline, or diligence, and principle. And we've lost that. And we're being divided by things like gender and race and every other group. And it's gotten to the point where it's turned out to be ridiculous, because the people who are preaching the tolerance are the most intolerant people out there.
Okay, so let's talk about your individual situation and what your life is like on a day-to-day basis. You're off the grid. That means you're off the electrical grid of the community that you live in. But as I said earlier, you have a phone, you have a computer. So what is your source of energy and what is your home life like?
Well, everything is simplified. We have no television. We have no traditional running water. We use a gravity feed from a 200-gallon water tank that we feed with a garden hose about every 10, 12 days. We have no traditional flushing toilet. We flush with a bucket of water we mostly use in the outhouse. We have no interior pipes. We have no hot water heater, no pressure tank. We heat our cabin with a Amish wood cook stove, and that's how we get our hot water. That's how we cook, and that's how we heat the cabin. So everything's real simple. We even harvest my own trees on my property. And, you know, when a tree dies from insects or gets blown over by the wind, I call it free heat. So we're, you know, I don't want to give people out there the impression that we're 100% self-sufficient. Nobody drills for their own oil and refines their own gasoline and works on their own vehicles anymore. But I try to be as self-sufficient as I possibly can because of what happened to me in the corporate world. And with my health, I've lost 90% of the strength in my arms from spinal stenosis and nerve damage. And I want to give people some confidence that if you have a debilitating disease, if you're old, you can still live this way. In fact, motion is lotion. And I try to tell people that living this way and keeping away from GMO foods, keeping away from hormones, steroids, antibiotics, pesticides, this is truly the way to do it, to live healthy, because we're building our immune system this way. So immune system deals with so many things, from inflammation, circulation, infection, detoxification, cancers and tumors, allergies. I mean, there's so many things, so many benefits to living this way, because it's, again, simpler and healthier.
In a perfect world, because it sounds idyllic, but in a perfect world, can a large portion of the population do what you want to do? Or is it a situation where it's only for a certain number, and then after that it becomes problematic?
Well, I think the answer to most questions is depends. It depends. I think, personally, Peter, that most people can do most things. And if you're going to let all these financial, economic, social, and political barriers stop you, then you're going to be a someday aisle, and you're not going to achieve those goals. So it all depends on you as a person. It depends if do you want to feed your family healthier food? Do you have a love and affinity for nature? 90% of Americans live in suburban urban America. 90%. When the Great Depression hit, 80% lived rural. I talked to families who their great grandparents and grandparents didn't even know there was a depression because they were so prepared with hunting and fishing and raising animals and growing produce. So I just think that with everything that's happening, with all the uncertainties that's happening financially, economically, socially, politically, all the corruption, all the distractions, all the division, you know, I just think this is a great lifestyle.
For all the pluses that you have garnered with your great lifestyle, is there anything that you miss about your days living in New York or living in a big city in general?
Well, you know, I loved living in New York. I don't want to give people the wrong impression. I make the best out of everything, no matter where I am. You know, I have a saying, the happiest people don't have the best of everything. They just make the best of everything. And I love the nightclubs. I grew up in the disco era back in the 70s and the early 80s. And I left New York at the perfect time. I was 26 years old. And, you know, I had to take the corporate path in order to get my final ducks in a row to live here. You know, I was in the big pharmaceutical industry for over 20 years and had to get 3 college degrees and wear a suit and tie and drive a company car. You know, you have to do what you have to do to get to your goals or whatever your dreams are. So it all depends on how you want to live. I know people who have tons of acreage, tons of wealth, and they live with a 48-volt system, and they have every appliance, every toy known to man. That's including all the electronic big TVs and everything. It depends how you want to live. And I know people who live with no electricity. So it all depends on what your game plan is.
Do you find it interesting that I'm sure there are people who, when they hear the way you're living and what you're doing, there are many people who think, oh, that's a great idea. It's a great lifestyle for him. And there are those who just don't get it?
Well, sure. And the people who I feel sorry for the most, Peter, are the people who don't have interest in hobbies, especially ones that haven't cultivated interest in hobbies. And I came to Montana for the outdoors, and not just hunting and fishing, but gardening, dendrology, ornithology, silviculture, edible and medicinal plants, wildlife identification, wildflower identification. We're big mushroom pickers. I mean, I can go on and on. There's so much to do in nature, and you got to go where your heart tells you to go. You know, and it depends. Go where your interests and hobbies are. And if you don't have interests and hobbies, you know, I feel sorry for those folks.
Great point indeed. People can find more information by going to your, you have a website, offgridmontana.com, correct?
That's correct.
And how can one get the book, One New York Man's Journey to Off-Grid Living in Montana?
Well, they can either go to my website, either click on Amazon.com, BarnesandNoble.com, and it's also available on eBay, or they can just skip my website and just go directly to that. But my website's kind of cool, Peter. I have, you know, there's hunting and fishing pictures for the person who's influenced by outdoor adventure. I have trail cam pictures, and neat pictures on there. Bear, I got a mountain lion stalking a deer. There's gardening pictures. There's animals we have on the hobby farm pictures. I mean, there's just a lot of, it's a lifestyle. It really is a lifestyle of self-sufficiency and frugality.
Rich, I thank you very, very much for taking the time to be on the program with us. It's most interesting indeed.
Oh, thank you for the opportunity, Peter. I appreciate it.
Rich Sheban, author of One New York Man's Journey to Off-Grid Living in Montana. You can go to my website at thestufffile.com, go to the What's On page for this show, which is show number 0237, and you'll find the links to Rich's website, plus links to either Amazon.com or Amazon.ca, where you can order his book directly. You're listening to the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder.
I'm Bob DiRigo Jones, and this is Let's Be Fair. I'd like to tell you about a man who walked into an IRS office with a $60,000 tax debt and left with an injury that would bring him over $800,000. Here's what happened. After agreeing on a plan to pay off his tax debt, the man stood up to leave the IRS office and tripped over a telephone cord. He fell against a file cabinet and then walked out to his car. Later, he filed a lawsuit alleging he was injured by his fall. After a trial, the judge ruled that the man was entitled to $112,000 for medical expenses. But then, the judge also awarded $750,000 for pain and suffering. Let's be fair, setting pain and suffering awards is a very controversial process. Judges often disagree on amounts. However, in this case, there's one thing that everyone agrees on. The pain and suffering of paying for this lawsuit will fall on all of us as taxpayers. Learn more. Visit our website at centerforamerica.org.
Hi, this is Wynonna Judd, and you probably don't think of me as a person with an eating disorder, but here's my truth. Eating disorders are real, and they are not just about losing weight. Eating disorders are the way you feel about your body and the way you treat yourself. For years, I have been a compulsive overeater, and it wasn't until its effects threatened my health, my family, and my career that I finally reached out for help. Recovering from an eating disorder is possible, and I'm living proof. But you have to take the first step, so I urge you to visit nationaleatingdisorders.org.
From our studios in Montreal, Canada, and going out to the rest of the world, this is the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder. It's time to crack a spine. The Stuff File presents Book Banter with Stuart Nallman. Once again, here's Peter Anthony Holder.
And yes, Stuart Nallman is here with us once again on Book Banter. Hello, Stu.
Hi, Peter, and we're going to crack a lot of spines tonight.
Crack a lot of spines, yes, of course, of course. How many spines are you planning on cracking?
Well, put it this way, this is on this edition of Book Banter, we're going to do a book about books.
A book about books?
Yeah.
Is that like a TV show about TV shows or movie
or
about
like,
movies?
Or like Kramer, coffee table, book about coffee tables, you know?
Exactly, yes.
Something to that extent. But, yeah, in particular, Joe Queenan, who's a terrific writer, critic, humorist. And, you know, I got to tell you something. The book, it's called One for the Books. Because in an age of the Kindle, the Kobo, or any other e-reader that seems to suddenly appear on the market, it may look like the age of the good old-fashioned physical book that contains words and pictures on paper pages and sounds interesting too, hard or soft covers would go the way of the dinosaur or even the VCR.
So you're talking about the, not about the e-book, but the dead tree book.
You got it.
Okay.
And, well, you know, not according to Joe Queenan, he has a devout passion for books, and he's particular of what the type of books he enjoys reading. His taste in books, to put it mildly, is quite eclectic. And it's particular of how he obtains his books and where he purchases them. And this book, One for the Books, is Queenan's no-holds-barred pontification about the joys of reading quality books and his growing concern about the future of the book at a time when one can easily download hundreds of titles into an e-reader. Now, in his own humble yet well-read opinion, Queenan explores the culture of books and reading books from his own personal perspective, in which he became a voracious reader as an escape from a harsh upbringing in the housing projects of Philadelphia. And from there, he continues along with an expansive exploration of different aspects of reading and reading culture, from what makes up his passion for reading to what makes him frustrated. For example, he laments about the decline of the independent mom-pop bookstore, his aversion to owning rare first editions from the 19th and early 20th centuries, and how he mistrusts book recommendations from other people, especially those who try to lend him their copies, and also the never-ending quest to read and finish the desired literary works that constantly pile up on his night table, especially his ongoing futile quest to finish George Eliot's novel, Middlemarch. Now, I've always enjoyed books about books, and because they reach out to those avid readers and true bookworms about what makes reading an honest-to-goodness paper book so much thrilling and affirming. Now, Queenan does the same thing with One for the Books, but he uses liberal doses of his trademark sarcasm and caustic humor to explore the joys of books and reading. And also, on a more personal note, I could readily identify with many of the issues that he seems to raise, because I have personally experienced them. I have also mourned the closing of many independent family-owned bookstores in my hometown of Montreal. I also have an aversion to buying and owning dusty, faded first editions from a century ago. And yes, I have also withstood several epic struggles to try and finish reading some desired tomes, including three failed attempts to read the first volume of Winston Churchill's six-volume history of the Second World War. Now, One for the Books is a book that speaks for the hardcore bibliophile, and Joe Queenan has become the symbol for those who still appreciate a good book in the manner it's supposed to be enjoyed. It shows that books continue to play a vital role when it comes to entertaining, informing, and enlightening people who bother to take the time to crack a spine. So all I can say is, hail Joe Queenan, hail Joe Queenan, and hopefully someday he will finally finish reading Middlemarch.
Aren't you afraid of when you read a book about books that you might go blind?
Or maybe. Or sometimes, you know, but sometimes a little like, you know what, I agree with Joe. Or maybe I should be reading this book. Or maybe I shouldn't be reading this book. Yeah, it sometimes reevaluates. I'm forced to reevaluate some of my reading choices.
Okay, so the book is?
It's called One for the Books by Joe Queenan, and it's published by Penguin Books, and it's $16 in trade paperback.
And dare I ask, are there any other books you can recommend that are about books?
Well, yeah, there's two in particular that come to mind. One is called The End of Your Life Book Club by Will Schwab, who talked about a book club that him and his dying mother shared, in her final years, which was one of my favorite books of 2012. And here's one rarity. If you can find it, do read it. It's called At Random by late Bennett Cerf. He founded Random House, and this was possibly published in 1977, about 6 years after his death, about how he put together this prestigious publishing firm and the great authors that he had a chance and the privilege to know and publish during his time running Random House, in between when he wasn't appearing on What's My Line.
Well, let me ask you this question.
Yeah.
We put you on a desert island.
Yeah.
What's the one book you can take with you?
Oh, Peter, that's a loaded question.
I know. That's why I only said one. Just one. What's that book?
Just one. Oh, you know I'd probably say Pierre Burton, but, I'm going to go with Groucho and Me by Groucho Marx, his autobiography from 1959.
In
its original hardcover edition.
You scared me for a second, because when you said Pierre Burton, I thought, I'm sure he's going to say Groucho Marx. So I was right. You made my heart stop for a second there, because I thought for sure you'd say Groucho Marx.
Oh, well, was that for a good thing or not?
Well, that means I know you, which is kind of frightening. But anyway, there you go.
If I said Pierre Burton, you maybe it was just as equally frightening.
Oh, no. There's not enough trees.
On that desert island.
Anyway, so again, this week's book was?
One for the Books. That's the name of the book. It's by Joe Queenan, published by Penguin Books. $16 in trade paperback.
And if people want to get in contact with you, find out how they can read what you do on a regular basis, how can they go about doing so?
Well, you can read me in the Montreal Times every week in paper, obviously. But if not, you can read me online, www.mtltimes.ca.
Thank you very much, sir.
Thank you, Peter. Now, back to cracking those spines.
Stuart Nolman with another edition of Book Banter here on the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder.
The Stuff File.
And we're just about a racetrack, but I got a couple more stories to share with you before we get to our idiot of the day. 28-year-old Shamel Batisse went to an Ocala, Florida car dealership ostensibly to buy a car. He asked to check out a car on the lot. Batisse, a paraplegic, asked to feel the seats, so salesman Anselmo Chico Barreto opened the car door for him. Next, Batisse said he wanted to see what the car felt like inside, so Barreto helped him out of his wheelchair and into the driver's seat. Then, he says, Batisse locked the door, started the car, and used a folding cane to hit the gas and took off. It was unbelievable, only like something in the movies, Barreto said. Police pursued Batisse through 3 counties but lost him. He was eventually spotted trying to fill up at a gas station and was arrested on charges of driving with a suspended or revoked license and Grand Theft Auto. Okay, let's see if we got this right. A 20-something paraplegic can outrun multiple cops thanks to a folding cane, and they only caught him because he stopped for gas. Yeah, these are only the kind of things that happen in Florida, by the way. Florida is one of the most bizarre states for bizarre stories. I basically owe a lot of my show to Florida. But anyway, moving right along, we're getting closer and closer to the idiot of the day. As a matter of fact, I like to call this story idiot adjacent, okay? The robber of a convenience store in Lorain, Ohio, wore a hood and scarf, but employees still recognized him by his voice. They told police that the robber was Eric Castillo, the brother of another employee at the store, Victor Castillo. They had originally thought it was a joke because they knew the voice when he was saying, "Give me the money," the responding officer wrote in his report. They were surprised to see a masked gunman when they turned around. The robber, they say, frequently visited his brother when he was working. Officers found the robber at a nearby bar and charged him with aggravated robbery, possession of cocaine, and possession of drug paraphernalia. Okay, now, as I said, you're probably thinking that someone that stupid has to be the idiot of the day, right? But no, as I said earlier, most weeks, you know, you would be right, but not in this case. This time, I would have to give him the silver medal. In other words, he's idiot adjacent, because this week's idiot has a similar story to share, and he's even dumber. I kid you not. So, without further ado, here is this week's idiot of the day.
And now it's time for the strange things adults do. This Stuff File presents the idiot of the day.
The robber of a Radio Shack store in Clearwater, Florida, wore a ski mask, but employees still recognized him. He ordered an employee to get on the floor, and when she tried to, he pepper sprayed her, so she ran. He tried to taser her, but ended up shocking himself instead, so then he ran. The alleged robber, Andre T. Puskis, age 20, is an employee of the store. He was arrested when, several hours later, he, yes, he, arrived back at the store for his scheduled work shift. Wow, his boss must be strict. No, seriously, why would someone walk into the place they work, attempt an armed robbery, botch the job because they tasered themselves, and then later show up for their next shift at the same location thinking that they couldn't possibly be caught? One reason, and one reason only: he's an idiot!
Gee, I'm only a kid, but even I know you're an idiot.
And that's it for this edition of the Stuff File program number 0237. Hope you enjoyed it. The website is thestufffile.com. And once again, stuff is spelled S-T-U-P-H, where you'll find information and links on all of our guests by going to the weekly Stuff File page. Just look for the corresponding program number. And once again, that's 0237. Email me at peter@thestufffile.com. You can also find me on Facebook and Twitter as PA Holder. And don't forget to check out the Stuff File store, where you can purchase a plethora of Stuff File merchandise, from t-shirts to mugs to tote bags to mouse pads. Hope to see you back here for our next show on the air, online, or as a download. We're coming to you from everywhere, including CyberStationUSA.com, KDXRadio.com, AirChecker, Canada's number one radio source, streaming on PCJ Media and its partner stations, TrueTalkRadio.com, downloaded on iTunes and Stitcher, and over the air on World FM in New Zealand, MediaCorp in Singapore, and WSTJ in St. Johnsbury, Vermont. That's it. Bye-bye.
You've been listening to the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder, a presentation of Flying Fish Communications. While it may be an enjoyable, pleasant experience, some side effects may occur. Listening to Peter may cause bloating, drowsiness, Tourette's, web feet, or an oily discharge.